On today's show, I'll be speaking with Joseph Wang of FedGuide.com and Dominique Dwarf-Foucault, senior strategist at MacroHive. To access a 40% discount to MacroHive Prime, go to macrohive.com/jack. I am joined by Joseph Wang at FedGuide.com and Dominique Dwarf-Foucault, senior strategist at MacroHive. Great to have you here again. Welcome.
Thanks, Jack. It's great to be with you too as well.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Great to see you again, Dominique.
So we are, of course, talking about the topic that everyone wants to know about, and that is NVIDIA. What happened? Why is the stock up 25%? What happened? What's going on with AI? What opportunity? No, of course, we're not talking about that at all. We're talking about another topic everyone wants to know about, the debt ceiling. I've been neglecting this on forward guidance, so it's a long...
Jack, it's as magical as NVIDIA.
Yes, there's a lot of magic we're going to be talking about, and it's not AI. So I'm going to start really simple. You're going to have to explain to me like I'm a fifth grader because I've been a little bit behind the curve. So the debt ceiling is how much money the U.S. government can borrow, and Congress has already apportioned to spend a certain amount of money. And they've screwed over the Treasury, basically, because the Treasury has to borrow that money in order to spend it. That's just what Congress has done. So the Treasury has to raise the debt ceiling, but now they need to go back to Congress. So Congress has to raise the debt ceiling. So basically, the U.S. government is running out of money. It could borrow more, but it's not allowed to because of the debt ceiling. Joseph, is that roughly accurate? And can you add a little color? What am I missing there?
So absolutely. So we have this thing in the U.S. called the debt ceiling. And basically, once upon a time, people saw that the federal government was issuing a lot of debt, and they thought that this was not good. So they created something called a debt ceiling. So once we hit the debt ceiling, we can't issue any more debt. And that's a problem for the U.S. because the U.S. always spends more than it receives in taxes. So this debt ceiling functionally is a negotiation tool for politicians who want to control the amount of spending the U.S. does. Now, the U.S. has been through this game many, many times. Sometimes the debt ceiling is lifted very easily, and we all go back to business as usual. But sometimes this becomes more of a problem. And in the past, it's even led to a downgrade of U.S. credit rating by S&P over a decade ago. So it looks like we're heading into another episode where the debt ceiling is a bit more contentious now. And as usual, there's one party who would like to have spending cuts because they view the government spending as unsustainable, and there's another party who is resisting that, and that's usually how this goes. But thankfully, there's a potential for disaster, but also a lot of tricks to avert disaster. And I guess Dominique could discuss some of the things that are happening now.
Yeah, let me just put this chart on screen. This is the U.S. debt in dark blue, and the orange dotted line is the debt limits. You see, it's been raised many times in Democrat, in Republican administrations. And generally, you know, the crisis event that could happen doesn't happen, thankfully. And we're recording this on the afternoon of Thursday, May 25th. And who knows, the U.S. could default on its debt, which would be a very bad event, needless to say. But you know, hopefully, Congress gets its act in order. Dominique, what do you have to say about this?
I have to say that people are panicking about the wrong things. First of all, in my view, there is a good chance that actually the government is going to hit the X date. The X date is basically the date when there is not enough cash in the treasury accounts at the Fed to pay for all the bills of the government. And when that happens, there is a bit of uncertainty. I personally tend to agree with the treasury. The first week of June seems likely. The assumption has been all along that there would be an agreement between Congress and the administration on raising the debt ceiling so that we would not hit that X date. In my view, it's more likely than not that it will not happen. US politics are more polarized. Also, we have a fairly weak Speaker of the House, you know, who has a group of about 35 House members who are very hardcore. The Republicans came up with a list of demands for raising the debt ceiling, which are really unacceptable to the Democrats. But those 35 House members publicly said that they would not back any compromise, that they wanted everything they had demanded in the bill they passed last month. And since the Republicans have a majority of 5 in the House, and the bill, the debt ceiling, their debt ceiling bill was passed by a majority of 2. Any compromise is going to have to be passed with Democratic votes, simply because you have this big chunk of Republicans who have publicly said we will not back any compromise. So that makes it more difficult to find an agreement. And I think there is a reason, another reason, which everyone is overlooking, for why we are likely to hit the X date, and that the X date is not the catastrophe that everyone says. There is this narrative which has been propagated by the administration and just about every media in the world, that if we hit the X date, it's equivalent to a default by the US. And I would agree that a default by the US would be an absolute catastrophe, that the damage to the market would be really hard to measure. We're talking about something very foundational being destroyed here. But that's not at all what's going to happen. Not at all. What's going to happen is that the government, the Treasury, has a lot of inflows, a lot of cash inflows, a lot more than what is needed to fund interest payments. And so what the Treasury is going to do is that it's going to prioritize interest payments. It's going to roll over its existing debt and pay non-debt service payment as cash becomes available. So it's going to prioritize. I mean, how do I know that? Because we have documents showing it. We have transcripts from the debt ceiling standoff of 2013 and 2011 saying exactly that. And then the Republicans, after the 2013 standoff, because they were told that payment prioritization was not feasible, subpoenaed a number of documents and got a number of individuals to testify. And surprise, surprise, it turns out that both the Treasury and the Fed had been running tabletop exercises. Obviously, they cannot do real exercises for payment prioritization. So there is a really, so if, let me rephrase this, if, you know, there was any real chance that hitting the X date would lead to the US government defaulting on its debt, we would have had an agreement between Democrats and Republicans quite a while ago. They both know that this idea is basically a negotiating strategy. It's lost its credibility, and that's why we are in this quagmire.
So the X date is the date at which the Treasury, U.S. government, actually runs out of money. Prioritization is prioritizing interest payments over other expenditures. So there are two expenses that the U.S. Treasury has to make: to pay for programs and then to pay for debt that it has already issued. For prioritization, it would pay interest on the debt and subordinate other claims like government workers. And it's a pretty very politically fraught issue. If you have, you know, the Saudi Arabian, sovereign wealth trust is being paid by the U.S. Treasury, but, nurses, firefighters, teachers are not being paid, that's, pretty screwed up. And it could be seen as being pretty screwed up. And I'll just flash on screen just the, some of the proposed cuts by the Republicans, which the Republicans like to, you know, fire over 10,000 FBI workers, cut Pell grants, reduce food stamps, which is through the Department of Agriculture. But setting any, so Joseph, we've got a lot of politics. Speaker McCarthy, he's going to the White House. They have a deal. He tells them on Bloomberg, we're going to do a good deal. Biden says things are going great. You know, so much is hinging on basically no information that's publicly released, essentially no information. So let's kind of skip past the politics, which, you know, could change hour by hour. And let's stick to the plumbing for now. So this is the Treasury General account, how much money the U.S. Treasury actually has in its account at the Federal Reserve, where, you know, as folks know, you used to work. And this chart is from your most recent article on FedGuide.com. So it's trending downward. The Treasury is running out of money. What happens if the Treasury runs out of money? You know, if I run out of money in my bank account, my bank will, you know, typically charge me an overdraft fee. And I'm not allowed to get much past zero, at least on a deposit checking account. I borrow money on a credit card, but can the U.S. government go below zero? Is the Fed going to charge the Treasury an overdraft account?
Yeah, that's a really good question. If the Treasury could have overdraft, life would be much easier, right? Just have them run like a $1 trillion overdraft, and we'll have no debt ceiling issues ever. But actually, legally, the Treasury cannot overdraft their Fed account. So again, this is just a procedure thing that, you know, could potentially be changed internally. But from what I understand, there's enormous resistance within the Fed to do something like that. Now, going back to Dominic's point about the X date, so there's tremendous uncertainty, as Dominic noted. Think about it from a personal perspective. Let's say you have a bank account, and every 2 weeks you get your paycheck, but then you also have outflows, you pay mortgages, you pay your credit card bill, you pay, you know, just random stuff that comes up. The U.S. government is just like that, except much, much more complicated. And so because of a lot of the factors that Dominic mentioned, there's enormous amounts of uncertainty as to the exact date that the Treasury will run out of money. So there's someone on Twitter called John Kaminsky that does really good work on forecasting this. And he's suggesting that we'll make it through June. But again, it's hard because I think what most forecasts are showing is that over the next 2 weeks, the TGA will fall really low and possibly go to zero. But if we make it past the 2 weeks, we go to June 15th, which you have corporate tax payment dates, so money comes in. And if we make it to the end of June, we have another set of extraordinary measures that kick in that frees up about $100 billion in cash. So if we can make it past the first 2 weeks in June, we could probably make it to August.
See, now, this is the magic I was talking about.
So it is magic because, you know, I suspect that even if for some reason that we hit the X date and we can't come up with a solution, they will figure something out. I think Dominic was mentioning earlier that there was an opinion article in the Wall Street Journal suggesting more magical, extraordinary measures that could free up more space. So, you know, the government is really, really creative. So I don't think of this as something very serious. But again, we have Secretary Yellen going on TV and saying the X date is really soon and then we can't prioritize payments and so forth. That's just a negotiation tactic. Those words are absolutely false. As Dominic mentioned earlier, we have the confidential documents that were subpoenaed by Congress showing that the New York Fed actually does have a plan to prioritize payments. It can be done. And so the prospect of a default, even if we go past the X date, is zero because, as Dominic mentioned, we're going to prioritize payments. And that's basically going to give the Treasury indefinite amounts of time. So Jack, you were mentioning that they would prioritize different payments. So what would happen is, like you mentioned, that money comes in every day from tax payments and so forth, and money goes out. What the Treasury would do was it would prioritize interest payments, and then it would roll over the principal payments. So if you had like $1 billion in treasuries due today, you would prioritize payments, pay interest, and then you would just roll it over. So the overall
principal.
Not pay
the principal. If you have $100 million.
No. You would pay the principal, but you would pay the principal by borrowing again. So just roll it over. So I have $100 billion due tomorrow. Then I issue $100 billion tomorrow for settlement tomorrow as well. So money comes in. from the new debt issuance, and then it goes out to repay those guys. So it just rolls over the borrowings. So a lot of people will say that this is illegal and unconstitutional. And I think it probably is, actually. I think Jim Bianco makes a really good point in that if the executive branch can just prioritize payments, then they're basically taking over Congress's job. So in the U.S., we have separation of powers where Congress decides what money to spend and how much. Now, if we have the executive branch prioritizing payments, well, they're taking Congress's job. Who's to stop, say, a politically motivated administration saying, you know what, I don't like climate change stuff, I'm not going to pay them. Or, you know, I don't like the military-industrial complex, I'm not going to pay them. So it is potentially very illegal. But the good news is we also know from the subpoena documents that Chair Powell at the time thought it was fine. So he's going to, it seems like he's willing to do it. I think the notes show that back then, even though there was some concern as to legality, he seemed to think, based on those notes, that, you know, by the time this gets to the courts, it'll be resolved. So it'll be, you know, a moot point. So this is something that the records indicate that the Fed is willing to do. And because of that, I don't worry about a default by the Treasury on Treasury securities at all.
So, Joseph, if default is not an issue, would the 1 month Treasury bills that are trading at a very steep discount, they're yielding 5.6%, while the rest of the curve yields 5% or lower, would those be a good investment?
It can be, but here's the thing though. Let's say there is a default. You're going to get your money back. Of course, we know eventually you're going to get your money back, but it could be later, right? It could be maybe 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, or something like that. You don't know. I mean, it's a small chance. So when you look at the Treasury bills, you have to kind of think about it from the perspective of who tends to buy those bills. They tend to be bought by money market funds, less so today than in the past, but they're still pretty big holder. And if you are someone who manages like a money market fund, you're really conservative. People view investments in your fund as deposits at a bank. You never want to be in a situation where you show on your public financial statements, because you have to file public financial statements at the end of every month, that you're holding bills that got defaulted on. That would be very, that would be humiliating. So, it's just not worth it. You're getting a little few basis points, and then you potentially show up in the headlines as the fund manager who bought defaulted Treasury bills. So
this is 1 month Treasury in blue yield versus a very low risk commercial paper in red, and 1 month the duration is the same, and you can see that 1 month Treasury yield is now higher than 1 month commercial paper rate from non-financial AA rated borrowers. And so this means that Microsoft, Apple, including some Chinese, oil companies can borrow at a lower interest rate than the US government, which is pretty remarkable. But Dominique, I know you've got a ton to say.
Well, I just wanted to come back to the comment you made about the Treasury running its accounts at the Fed in the red. And I think it's a really interesting question, because it really shows the dilemma for the Fed. So in their view, and again, I'm just quoting from the transcript, that data is there for anyone to see. The biggest risk from a debt ceiling crisis, the biggest risk from that to financial stability is a failed auction. As a main manager of financial risk, the Fed is going to do its utmost to ensure that auctions do not fail. And so they have a whole list of, in the transcript, of things they could do. Among those things is the possibility of setting up, of either buying not defaulted securities, because I don't think a default is likely, but securities where people have doubts, or swapping them against so-called unblemished securities. But there is a problem there for the Fed, which is really quite fundamental. They are an independent institution, but they had to fight hard to become independent because during World War II, they were completely subordinated to the funding of the war effort. And the war ended, but the Fed remained subordinated to the Treasury. And so this took some working, but in 1951, they made an accord with the Treasury that gave them their independence and made them allowed them to design monetary policy independent of the Treasury funding needs and issuance policy. And so the risk for them is that if they give too much support to the Treasury market, they could be seen as actually underwriting what is basically political dysfunction. I mean, in my view, there is an argument to be made that QE does exactly that, but let's not get into it. It's for another discussion. So there is a little bit of a dilemma here on how they structure their market intervention to make sure that they are not basically funding the deficit with money creation or with quasi-money creation. And so the solution they came up with is that they would buy securities, they would buy defaulted bonds or bonds about which the market has doubts. They might swap them for their own pristine bonds, but they would do it at market value. And another issue that is likely to come up is the sequencing of communication. Because it's not, I mean, we're not going to hit the X day and the day after the Treasury and the Fed will tell us about what they intend to do. I mean, if we hit the X date without preparation or special measures by the Fed and the Treasury, the market is going to collapse. So what's likely to happen?
Market, bond market.
Everything. I mean, come on. It means that the U.S. government, the most important market in the world, suddenly it may not function. Suddenly you have issues about doubts about solvency. So the sequencing is likely to be one where the Treasury that has better visibility than us on how much money is in the government bank account, because we get this data with a day lag, they get it in real time. And trust me, right now there are a number of people at the Treasury and the Fed whose job it is to count every cent coming and going from the government account. So they have better visibility. And so the day before the X date, we're probably going to have the Treasury announce the prioritization measures. And once those measures have been announced, the Fed will announce a series of measures to make sure that we don't end up with a failed auction. Because if we do, then we're talking about a very, very different world. We're talking about very deep market dislocation. And I see this as a tail event based on my optimism that rationality will prevail. But you do have this dilemma for the Fed of not doing enough and watching the market crash or doing too much and being seen as basically underwriting fiscal profligacy and political dysfunction.
And so, Joseph, what exactly would be in the Fed's toolkits based on the documents that you and Dominique are referring to? Would this be repo? Would this be purchases of securities?
So I think Dominique makes a very good point about the potential for fiscal dominance and that the Fed kind of has to subserve its mandate to Treasury. But the Fed itself also has a financial stability mandate. And so that's something they worry about as well. Now, mechanically speaking, so like I said, I don't believe there's going to be a default. I think it's all out of the question. But of course, nothing is impossible. In that very, very small possibility, let's say there is a default. What would be a problem is that, let's say that you are an investor, you have a mandate that you can't hold defaulted securities. Maybe, just maybe, you're forced to sell that, and that could be very disorderly. Now, I suspect that's not going to happen. If you are a manager with such a mandate, you could probably get an exception from your board to say that, yeah, treasury securities, they're okay. Another potential place where the mechanics could be impacted is in the repo market. So repo, you have literally over $1 trillion of securities, of treasury securities. So people lend and hold treasury securities as collateral. They lend against them. Now, there's a possibility that whoever is lending in the repo market won't want to hold defaulted treasuries as collateral. And then that could also be a potential mess. Say they liquidate that collateral, or perhaps they demand a collateral that's not defaulted. Now, these are just potential very, very, very far tail risks, but not impossible. So what could happen if the Fed wanted to wade in and fix that would be, as Dominic suggested, just go and just have the Fed buy all the defaulted securities. Then, you know, the Fed is happy to hold defaulted securities. They don't really worry about that stuff. Another possibility would be to Fed to have some kind of facility and be willing to swap securities that defaulted for securities that have not defaulted. As we know, the Fed still has this tremendous portfolio of QE securities, and they could easily provide the market with securities that are not in danger of defaulting. So at a high level, treasury securities pay interest every 6 months. So you can always find a whole bunch of treasury securities that don't pay interest this month or next month, and those wouldn't be at risk of default.
So those would be zero coupon instruments. And I'm imagining, instead of exchanging a pristine treasury security for a defaulted security, or as Dominique said, one about which the market has doubts, they would give their pristine collateral via the reverse repo facility and take in the doubt securities via repo?
It doesn't have to. It could be. They could just simply go out and just swap them, or they could repo them. They could do like securities lending, where you could post defaulted securities as collateral and in turn borrow securities that where there is no doubt. There's a lot of different ways to do this.
Right. I suppose, what is a default? You know, like if you were if you're a real estate developer and, you know, Joseph, you give me a loan, I can't pay it back. It would be bad for you if I default. So you restructure it. It's sometimes called extend and pretend, where, okay, Jack, you actually can give me the money at a later date and we'll change the terms. We'll make it work. What counts as a default? If, you know, like no matter what happens, unless it's amazing, Joseph and Dominic, you know that there are going to be people on Twitter that say that the Treasury defaulted. My question is, what actually counts as a default? Whether you want to say, you know, it triggers a credit default swap contract where, you know, the market, they get triggered, and people who bet that the Fed that the Treasury would default, they get paid off on their credit default swap, or, you know, is it counted as a default if, Joseph, as you said earlier, I own a Treasury and I redeem it, and instead of being paid back in, I guess, reserves or bank deposits, I get given another Treasury. Does that count as a default? What to you, Joseph, counts as a default?
Well, if I have a coupon payment I should receive and I don't get it, that's a default. Or of course, if I do in principle and I don't receive it, I think that's a default. You know, when I look at, I don't believe, you know, I think that if you paid a treasury security interest with another treasury security, I don't think that's part of the agreement.
In practice, the US government never repays its debt, right? I think, if I remember correctly, the total marketable debt of the US fell under the Clinton administration, but has never fell since. So it's never the case. I mean, let me put it this way. It hasn't happened in a very long time that Uncle Sam has actually been paying down its debt.
Dominic, in net terms, you're absolutely right. I think maybe 99 or 2001 was, there's one year, the Clinton year, where the US ran a surplus. You know, every year since then has been a deficit, but it still could be the case that when I redeem my treasury security, I get paid in, as a bank, I get paid in reserves, or if I'm a customer, I get paid in deposits rather than being paid in another security, even if net net, as you say, of course, you're right.
So you could be paid in reserves, but as long as the treasury is able to refinance, you know, it will get other investors to give it cash. Mm-hmm. And that's how it's going to keep going. So the issue is really to make sure that there is no failed treasury auction. And that's where I think we can expect the Fed, you know, to come in with all kinds of assurances after the Treasury has announced payment prioritization. And the sequencing is important to make clear that the Fed is withdrawing operational risk from the market rather than helping to fund a huge deficit with its printing presses.
Right. And in March 2020, some, you know, across the political spectrum attributed to the Federal Reserve debt monetization of the Treasury, but the Federal Reserve plausibly said that they were just acting in financial stability. And Joseph, earlier you referenced the Federal Reserve could do the same thing this time around.
Yeah, they could just buy up all the defaulted securities. It seems like it would be in line with their mandate, and they could just claim that it was very targeted, right? There's some financial dysfunction, something wrong with the plumbing, quote unquote, and just go in and just buy up all the defaulted securities, or they could just swap them out, or they can just, you know, they could accept them as repo collateral, as you mentioned, Jack, or they could open them up and say, let them, encourage everyone to pledge them as collateral in a SEC lending operation, and in exchange for that, just give them, give whoever participates, clean treasuries. There's just a lot of ways to deal with this. The Fed has really grown in its toolkit. And so it really takes, I think it takes tail risk out of the picture.
And it's not just that the toolkit has grown, but the willingness to use it. I mean, if you look at the expansion of the Fed balance sheet in the early stages of the pandemic, it's still to this day, it leaves me speechless. So my advice to investors would be don't fight the Fed.
That's always good advice.
Hey there, hope you're enjoying the show. Wanted to remind you that you can get 40% off to an annual subscription of MacroHive Prime at www.macrohive.com/jack. We've included Dominique's piece on the debt ceiling as a sample in the description so you can see the rigor and quality that you can expect from MacroHive's research. An annual subscription usually runs you $374 per year, but by going to macrohive.com/jack or by using code Jack, you can get it for only $220 per year. That's over a 40% discount. Thanks, and let's get back to the interview. We don't know what the Federal Reserve is going to do. I mean, it sounds like you both are saying you do know what the Federal Reserve is going to do because you saw its playbook from the last debt ceiling.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay.
We know. That's why the market doesn't care. We already know what's going to happen. They've shown their hands. So that's why there's, you know, you can see that supposedly, if you read the news, it's really scary. Things are really tense. But then you look at the markets, you know, NVIDIA going to the moon, VIX really low, you know, everything is okay.
So I saw some, I think, JP Morgan note about the last debt ceiling crisis of, I think, 2011. Was accompanied with, you know, a stock market fall and a VIX spike up as well. Dominique, do you expect, you know, as a market strategist, do you expect the same scenario where market volatility will go up? And market volatility, as we all know, is typically a euphemism for stocks going down, risk assets going down.
Yeah. So, of course, but here is what's interesting about it. 2011, yeah, big panic, stocks go down. 2013, which was as acrimonious as 2011, nothing. I have a graph in one of my notes. You couldn't see any sign of the standoff anywhere. Why? Because people assumed that it would get resolved, and it did get resolved. But the issue this time around is that the parties are further apart than before. I think it's basically U.S. politics becoming more polarized. So in order to bring the parties together, you need them to get scared. And right now, no one is scared because everyone is expecting that this will get resolved as usual. So that's why I think that to get to resolution, we need a big burst of market volatility. And one way of getting this burst in market volatility is to hit the X date. The problem, though, is that if Joseph and I are correct with our expectation of contingencies from the Treasury and the Fed, this could put a floor under the market. Because when you think about it, debt ceiling conundrum, once you've taken out the risk of default, it's basically a nastier form of government shutdown. So it could be quite sustainable. And if it's sustainable, it weakens the incentive to make a deal. So, you know, the last government shutdown in 2018-19 lasted 35 days. You know, I hope this standoff will get resolved faster. But there is this paradox that for resolution, you need a sell-off. And the sell-off is not happening because people expect the resolution.
Got it. These magical measures that you two are discussing, they sound like a temporary solution. Oh, if the X date comes, the Treasury runs out of money, they can do XYZ. The Federal Reserve can do ABC, DEF, GHI. But at the end of the day, Congress does have to raise the debt ceiling, right?
We hope. Yes, they do. I mean, it's just like the government shutdown. I mean, they last a ridiculous number of days, but eventually the two parties have to be brought together. And in my view, you know, if it turns out that people are, I'm correct and people are surprised that this sort of twilight zone that we have without a debt ceiling and without a default, if this is sustainable, I still think there will be a sell-off because in effect, what would happen is that for lack of cash, the government would have to operate a balanced budget. And right now, if you look at the 12-month deficit, it's 7% of GDP, which, by the way, is crazy, considering that unemployment is at a 50-year low. But just ignoring, you know, the fiscal profligacy of the current administration, in this twilight zone, the government would have to go from a deficit of 7% of GDP to a balanced budget. And that would be enough for a recession. And expectations of recession, in my view, would be enough to bring the sell-off we need to get out of the twilight zone.
Joseph?
So one thing I note about this, if we go into payment prioritization, let's say we go into payment prioritization for months, you know, we could continue to function and there'd be no default, but people would not get paid. You could have government workers who are not receiving their paychecks, or you could have, let's say, government vendors like military contractors not getting paid. So from my perspective, it seems like that would put pressure on the government to come to a resolution because you'd have all these government workers who are complaining. You'd have these big donors who are complaining they're not getting paid. And that creates a kind of a political channel that forces negotiation. And I also note in agreement with Dominique that the fiscal deficit is really exceptional. And that's part of the reason why the economy has been strong and inflationary is because we have a deficit spending that's, you know, that's really high for the economy that we have. Now, when we were not in recession, things were going well, there's no reason we need to have so much fiscal stimulus in effect. So this debt ceiling is basically doing its job as it was intended to act as a tool to shrink the government deficit a bit, which I think would be healthy for the longer term. I don't think anyone doubts that our fiscal trajectory is obviously not sustainable. We are already very inflationary. And before any cuts right now, it's projected to be, you know, $1 or $2 trillion a year forever. And the fiscal deficit is.
Right. I want to put up a chart, Dominique, that comes from you and your work at MacroHive. It's a bit complex, so I'm going to explain it up until the point that I can and then hand the reins off to you, Dominique. So in blue, we have the TGA balance, Treasury General Account, how much in billions the Treasury has with the Federal Reserve at its accounts. And the orange bars are the extraordinary measures, what Dominique, what you call the magical measures. And then the gray and golden lines are how much net outflows the Treasury would incur with and without extraordinary measures. So without extraordinary measures, you know, the gray line, the U.S. government would run out of money sooner with the extraordinary measures. And again, I believe this chart from MacroHive is from, you know, a week or two ago. The X date is somewhere around June, counting in those orange bars. But so what are the extraordinary measures, those orange bars? And I believe there's something that's different than the Federal Reserve extraordinary measures, but these are Treasury extraordinary measures that the Treasury has acknowledged, whereas the sounds like the Federal Reserve plans are something that, you know, you'd have to go through the transcripts of the old Fed meetings and plans to do. And so what were the extraordinary measures of the Treasury, and what perhaps even more extraordinary, even more magical measures are at the Treasury's disposal?
Okay, so this chart is not as clear as it could have been. Basically, the way it was supposed to work is that if you extend horizontally the blue line, it's going to hit the gray line and give you the X date. Let me explain why. So the gray and yellow line are my best forecast of the net outflows from the TGA, and the two lines are the sum of the withdrawal up to the end of June. Now, the magical orange bar. So basically, the government issues two types of debt. One type is called marketable debt, so that's debt we can buy and institutional investors have in their portfolio. And that debt is used to fund the budget deficit. And then they issue something else called non-marketable debt, which is not funding anything, but actually supplying investment vehicle, a sort of intergovernmental accounts and accounts like the civil service thrift plan can invest in. And that second type of debt does not fund anything. But both types of debt are subjected to the debt limit. So the magical extraordinary measures basically consist in lowering the second type of debt by not reinvesting the maturing debt, non-marketable debt, to create room for issuing more of the marketable debt that is actually funding the government deficit. So the bar on the screen, the total comes from a document that was issued by the Treasury. Once the debt ceiling is hit, when that happens, the debt ceiling declares a DISP, meaning debt issuance suspension period. And it's up to the Secretary of the Treasury to decide how long the DISP will last, and also up to her to extend it. And under that DISP, the Treasury is allowed to do the substitution I was talking about, to not roll over the non-marketable debt that matures, which creates room to issue marketable debt. And so the bars are based on a letter sent, an update published on the Treasury website at the beginning of the month that I showed about 90 billion of magical measures available until the end of the current DISP, so until June 5th. And then there is another 145 billion that will be available at the end of June. if the Treasury Secretary extends a DISP to that date, which is very likely. So this sort of a magical, extraordinary measure, it's, if you will, additional breathing room for the Treasury to issue marketable debt and fund a little bit more of its deficit. So the amount reflects the Treasury's communications to Congress. The timing of my little bars, especially the first four small bars, that is my forecast. So, yeah, I agree. This is a little complicated. I could have tried to make it simpler. But the idea here is to show basically the X date based on what is happening to the blue line, which is cash that the Treasury has in the bank, i.e. the Federal Reserves.
Right. And so what is an example of this non-marketable debt?
So the one that is talked about is the one that has been listed by the Treasury as part of the extraordinary measure. But it's basically, I mean, it's basically the debt of intra-government account, Medicare, Medicare Trust Fund, Social Security Trust Fund. So the one that is has been mentioned by the Treasury and is involved in the extraordinary measure is a debt that has been issued to the Civil Servant Retirement and Disability Fund. I never get the acronyms correctly. And the Postal Service Health Benefit Fund. So these are small funds, and you have the Civil Service Thrift account. They have, so if you are a civil servant, you can save and invest in different types of funds. And one of those is a G fund, is a fund made of government securities issued especially to that fund. So these are some of the key example of those government accounts.
And these are non-interest-bearing, the non-marketable securities?
They are interest-bearing. They are interest-bearing, but they are just issued to this account. They cannot be sold or traded in any way. They are just issued for the purpose of providing an investment vehicle to these accounts. You also have the state and local government issues, bonds that are issued to state and local government because of some complicated rule about taxes that limit state and local government investment universe. And so the Treasury as a service to them is issuing special non-marketable securities. That, by the way, also counts for the debt limit.
Got it. So they'll just issue fewer of these securities to sub-governmental organizations, which hold them as assets, and they'll issue more marketable securities, which the market can absorb. What are the consequences of that, Joseph, if they're fewer non-marketable security? I mean, this is a pretty niche topic, way over my head. What do you think, Joseph?
It just means that there's more magical measures, more room under the magical measures to extend the debt ceiling. So I think there was an op-ed that Dominic mentioned earlier that they could actually create more of these, let's say, have the Social Security Trust Fund just not invest in non-marketable securities. And instead, because they're not investing in non-marketable securities, that reduces the amount of securities under the debt limit and gives more headroom for the Treasury so they can just keep this going. So if you work in the US, every paycheck you have, some of that money is taken out for the Social Security Trust Fund. That's our retirement fund. FICA. So money goes out of your paycheck, goes into the Social Security Trust Fund, who then turns around and invests it into these non-marketable Treasury securities. So that's how the plumbing works. The state and local, special state and local government securities is actually really interesting. So as many of you know, in the US, if you are a state and local government and you issue debt, it's not taxable on the federal level. So they can issue at pretty low interest rates. Now, there's a temptation for these state governments to issue at low interest rates, take that money, and then reinvest in treasury securities for an ARB. So they can't do that. So the reason they can't do that is because the federal government forces them to, if they buy treasuries, to buy these special state and local series. That's how they came to be.
Got it. Joseph, I'm going to put up something from your most recent article on FedGuy.com. I didn't really understand it, but it was about treasury bill funding.
Yeah.
And so highly relevant. What are we looking at here?
So there's some chatter in the market about a potential huge liquidity drain when one day the debt ceiling resolution gets passed. Like we were showing earlier, as the treasury gets towards the debt ceiling X date, its checking account goes towards zero. However, the federal government doesn't like to have a checking account that's at zero. It wants to have a cash buffer. It tells you what cash buffer it wants quarterly. So at the end of June, its cash buffer target is $550 billion. Its target for the end of September is $600 billion. So once the debt ceiling is resolved, the Treasury is going to have to issue a lot of debt, take that money, and just kind of deposit it in its checking account as its cash buffer. As many of you who follow forward guidance know, and probably have become more acquainted with a little bit of the plumbing in the financial system, when the TGA goes up, that usually means that liquidity in the banking sector goes down. So money comes out of the banking sector into and gets stuck into the TGA. That has an impact that's very much equivalent to quantitative tightening. If you are an investor, just thinking about from the investor's perspective, you are giving up cash and in return receiving a treasury security. It tightens financial conditions a bit. There's some concern that this huge surge, it might be contractionary in a short amount of time. I think that's probably right. That's going to be a tailwind for risk as it happens. May not be severe, but it's something to keep in mind.
So the Treasury General Account is how much money the Treasury has. Historically, like before 2007 and before, it was a number that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, we would now call pretty close to zero. You know, back in 2006, they were like, oh my God, $6 billion. That's a lot of money. But now we say that's basically zero, you know, because, you know, okay. So I'm going to put up a chart. The red line is the TGA. And the blue line is the level of bank reserves throughout the entire bank system. Which Joseph, you wrote about, it's got a LCLOR, lowest comfortable level of reserves. If I put this chart back, you know, it would have both very close to zero in 2007. And even in 2011, 2012, the TGA was pretty close to zero. Why is it a problem now that the Treasury, you know, only has, you know, $50, $100 billion when in 2012 they had like $6 billion and there wasn't that big of a problem?
Yeah, so once upon a time, the Treasury actually not just had very small amounts of cash in their checking account at the Fed, they even had checking accounts at commercial banks. So you could have the U.S. Treasury with a checking account at J.P. Morgan. So the reason that they acted that way was because before 2008, the Fed controlled rates through what's called a scarce reserve system. And so they tried to move the overnight interest rates by just adding or subtracting reserves in the banking system. And that was, it's hard to do that if you have a TGA that's kind of moving around a lot. So in order to make the TGA not move around too much, the Treasury had checking accounts at the commercial banks. And so when they were receiving inflows, like say tax payments, it wouldn't have to necessarily flow to its checking account in Treasury at the Fed. It could flow to its checking accounts at the commercial banks. After 2008, the entire financial plumbing changed where the Fed no longer controlled rates by controlling the quantities of reserves, but by toggling the reverse repo facility rate. And so at that time, you know, and of course, many banks went bust during 2008. So everyone was thinking that it's much better for the banks and the Treasury to keep their cash on account at the Fed rather than with each other. And so there is a huge shift in how everyone thought about safety, where everyone now wants to keep cash at the Fed. The U.S. Treasury fell into that category as well, and they also revised their operating procedures such that they wanted to keep a minimum of about $150 billion on deposit at the Fed, or 5 days of outflows, whichever is more, I believe. So that's kind of why now you see that the Fed has, the Treasury has so many more reserves at the Fed. Now, whether or not that's a problem is a whole other issue. Now, looking at this chart you have before, you can see, for example, in 2021, you see the red line, the TGA being sent down. That's cash going out of the Treasury's checking account in the Fed and going into the commercial banking system. And so you see the blue line, reserves rising. Now, there's a common thought in the market where when this happens, you know, it's liquidity positive because the private sector has more low-yielding liquid assets and they rebalance that into riskier assets. And so that's risk positive. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways to think about it. But, you know, in 2021, we did kind of have a monster rally. And there's a thinking that goes that if this were to reverse, so let's say that red line goes up and the blue line goes down, that would be risk negative. So mechanically, what would happen is that if you are an investor, you had $100,000 of deposits in your account, if you were trying to maximize risk and return by, you know, shuffling that into riskier assets, but now because of what happened, you don't have $100,000 in cash sitting around that you want to rebalance. You have $100,000 worth of treasuries, let's say yielding 4 or 5%, and you're happy with that. And so you have no reason to rebalance your portfolio into riskier assets. And so risk assets would not appreciate as much. So that's usually the thinking that goes into this line of inquiry. So in the coming months, it's likely going to be very rapid drain, actually, from what I see.
Right. So in 2021, red line went down. Government was spending money, putting money into the financial system. The Fed was putting money into reserves, expanding reserves, blue line up. You know, very few things are certain in finance, but it does seem pretty likely that over the next few months, it will have the opposite. Red line will go up as the government refunds itself, and the blue line will go down as the Federal Reserve continues quantitative tightening. And by the way, the most recent tick up, that blue line, the reserves, is that the discount window and the Bank Term Funding Program? Right. So, Joseph, when you say you expect the draining to happen quite quickly, can you just walk us through what you mean by that?
So, historically speaking, now the Treasury, once the debt ceiling is resolved, is going to issue a lot of debt because, you know, it's kind of been starving itself. Once the debt ceiling is resolved, it has a lot of ceiling and it issues a whole bunch of bills and so forth. It wants to have its cash balance to be closer to its target level. So you could have, you know, so based on the chart that you just showed us, Jack, this Treasury forecasts bill issuance to be about $1 trillion in 6 months. That's historically a very high level of bills. And on top of that, you also have coupon issuance, which is also large and probably has to be adjusted higher depending on whether or not we get severe spending cuts.
Got it. Okay. So Dominique, if you were to offer a conclusion of our conversation today, how would you paraphrase it? If the mainstream narrative is the government's going to run out of money and it's going to be a disaster on one side, or it's actually a nothing burger and Congress will, you know, get its act together on the other, where would you sort of characterize your own views on that spectrum?
In the middle. It's not a catastrophe, but you're still going to have a good amount of volatility because that volatility is probably what is required to sort out the issue. From a macro perspective, to me, the risk is that this volatility could delay Fed tightening. The market is now pricing a full 25 basis point hike between June and July. In my view, given what is happening with the data, there is cause to hike in July. The risk in June, sorry. The risk is that we will be in the middle of a crisis, that the Fed will have to pause its tightening, possibly even expand its balance sheet, while the crisis itself is likely to get resolved without lasting damage to the economy. So paradoxically, the crisis could actually turn inflationary. Because where we are in the cycle, we need more policy tightening. And this whole debt ceiling conundrum is going to change the Fed focus. Instead of focusing on inflation, the Fed is going to have to focus on financial stability, pause its tightening, and possibly expand its balance sheet in order to maintain financial stability. And I expect that when the standoff gets resolved, it will get resolved in a fairly short order so that it will not leave a lasting impact on the economy. So we'll go back to the inflation and growth trend that we had, but with a Fed that is further behind the curve.
Got it. So there are a lot in the market who think that the economy has already entered a recession, about to enter a recession. You know, I guess the metaphor is if you have a baby tooth and, you know, you're pulling it out and it has that final string, like that last string was the bank panic of March, the fall of Silicon Valley Bank. And that basically, you know, from an economic perspective, it's over. Both you, Dominique, and you, Joseph, are united in the view that the economy is not in a recession and actually has been quite resilient and robust, for which there is, you know, a lot of evidence. I'd love for you to walk us through that. Dominique, you first, you follow, you know, the whole macroeconomic data that's released every day. And then Joseph, you, who I know you've been focusing a lot on bank lending, which has not contracted by, you know, as much as people say, perhaps, as well as housing. Dominique, you first.
Sure. So look at NFP. I mean, right now,
non-farm payroll,
employment. Right now, labor demand is growing twice as fast as labor supply. So unemployment is rock bottom, and wage growth is real wage growth has been accelerating, but even nominal wage growth is really picking up. Other thing to look at is household income. I mean, the U.S. economy is 70% consumption. So if you understand what's going on with household, you understand where the economy is going. Real household income, excluding government transfers, which gives you a good sense of how sustainable the expansion is without government support. It's turned around for the past 9 months. It's accelerating. And historically, it's been a really good predictor of expansion and recession. That is doing extremely well. Look at household savings, which are still well below historical norm. About historical norm pre-pandemic was about 7-8%. Now it's 5.5%. It's rising, but very slow.
Household savings sounds like a good thing economically, but when people save a lot of money, they don't spend. So a low savings rate means people are spending money, which means a hot economy.
Exactly. When people save, it means they are buying financial assets instead of buying, you know, cars, restaurant meals, or whatever. If you look at inflation indicators, if you look at a measure that's a good indicator of trend, core inflation, which is basically Chair Powell's number one concern at the moment, it's services inflation, excluding housing, is not slowing. And if you look at other measures like median price inflation, it's stuck in its range. And that's what even very dovish members of the FOMC, for instance, Philip Jefferson, that's basically what he has been saying. So in my view, the data is pointing only in one direction.
Joseph?
So when I think about how monetary policy is supposed to slow down the economy, there's a few channels. One of them is slowing down interest rate sensitive sectors of the economy. And the other, of course, is the wealth effect. You're making financial assets go down. Now, just looking at those two, it doesn't really seem to be working all that well. Now, let's look at the most, what we commonly think of as the most interest rate sensitive sector, housing. Now, mortgage rates, as of recording today, are 7%. And they were about 6 to 7% for the past few months. And you would expect, with mortgage rates soaring this high, for there to be an absolute implosion in the housing market. And many people were expecting that. But then if you just go and just open up Builder Stocks, Toll Brothers, Pulte, anyone like that, they're all around all-time highs. And if you look at the measures of home prices, let's say from Redfin, yes, we did decline year over year. But for the past 2 months, we seem to be stabilizing and in some areas of the country, heading higher. So I thought this was like this a huge mystery because it did not behave in the way that I thought it would. So I listened to a few home builder calls, and what I found was really interesting. So what's happening is that because so many people refied into, let's say, sub 5 or maybe around 3% mortgages, no one wants to sell their home, even if they have to move. So what that means is that the supply of homes on the market, the inventory of homes, is really low. And because you have very low supply, even though demand is lower because of high mortgage rates, prices aren't really falling very much. In fact, they're stabilizing. So Toll Brothers' call had a really interesting observation. They noted that usually we have about 10-15% of homes on the market are new construction. Now it's about 35%. And that simply speaks to the fact that everyone who has a low mortgage doesn't want to sell. And if that's the case, well, a couple of things follow. One is that you're not going to have a crash in prices simply because there's just not enough inventory. Secondly, the real economy impact of housing unemployment is that house prices tank, builders lay off people because they don't want to build houses anymore. But if you look at construction employment, it's growing. People, builders, look, when I listened to Pulte's call, they noted that we're hiring people. Why? Because there's tremendous demand for new construction homes. And, if there's no resale, if you buy a home, you can either buy a used home from someone else, that's called resale, or you can go to a builder and buy a new home. And because there's no resale, everyone's going to a builder. That's giving them market power. It's giving them actually pretty good sales. So that's why their stocks are at all-time highs. That's why doesn't seem to be very much layoffs in construction. And that's why house prices aren't really correcting. And that's also why monetary policy doesn't seem to be working in the same way that it used to. So if you're looking for that channel to work, it's not working. Now, the second channel of monetary policy, obviously, is to make people a little bit poorer by making stocks go down. So as of recording today, NVIDIA, a few hundred billion dollars in capital, basically trading like a penny stock, going up 25-30% a day. Now, you can't possibly look at this and be like, oh my gosh, interest rates are too high, right? So that doesn't seem to be working either. Now, another channel, Jack, that you mentioned was bank lending. And so bank lending throughout the year has been slowing but steady. Over the past 2 weeks, it's been pausing a bit, and we're going to see how that plays out. If you listen to any Fed speaker, they'll tell you that I'm focusing laser focused on this. My own view is that banks have been tightening lending standards for the past several months, almost a year. Totally normal because we're heading into the economic cycle where things slow down. I don't think that what happened in March was a systemic event or that it had a very big impact on bank lending overall. If you listen to Kashkari, he'll tell you in a speech that, this is something I'm watching. I haven't really heard the March bank panic had a big impact on banks in my district. If you listen to Roy Logan in her speeches, you'll see something similar. I suspect that what happened in March was pretty localized. And after we shake it off, the banks will go back to slower but steady loan growth. So I think in that aspect, monetary policy is having some impact. But overall, as Dominique eloquently put it, inflation doesn't seem to be going away. The economic growth is still okay. I think the Fed would be, it wouldn't be unreasonable for them to hike again. I think that there is a chance that we could hike again in June. But in any case, we're really close to the top of the cycle. definitely, though, definitely no cuts this year.
Right. So I think the last time we spoke, Joseph, your where you thought the Federal Reserve would peak out at was maybe 5.5, 5.75, maybe 6%. And we got to 5.25%. And then maybe you want to factor in the, you know, how much of a hike or how many hikes the credit contraction is. I mean, even Jay Powell has said that maybe 25 basis points, maybe 50 basis points. So we could be there, but we may get another 25 basis points in June. And as Dominique said, the market is pricing in that we will get one, if not by June, then by July. So some interesting moves in the short-term interest rate markets, which are, you know, always moving. Dominique, when we spoke with Joseph in February, you really stood out with your call. You know, Joseph stood out, was saying that the 10-year would get to 4%. And that was, you know, a one in 100 call when he did it in 2021. You went further. You know, you were with Joseph on that. You went even further and said that you thought the Fed could hike to 6%, 7%. You even floated 8%. Is that still within the realm of possibility right now as we record May 25th, especially given that a lot of the bank's issues have been, you know, exacerbated by the fact that interest rates are so high?
So the 8% call, which dates back to April 2022, was basically the Taylor rule. All I did was to compute a Taylor rule. There are many ways of computing one. So I'd say, you know, based on which price index, which weight you used, it was about 7 to 8%. And historically, the Taylor rule has been a really good predictor of the terminal rate in every cycle since the 1960s. So all I did, all the call was about was to say the Taylor rule is still relevant. And my Taylor rule estimate at the moment is about 8-9%, which, I mean, it's a formula. So change the formula and you'll get a different number, but it's much higher than where we are now. And obviously, you know, with the furor around the debt ceiling, all the drama, the storm and drang of the U.S. economy and politics, it sounds a little outlandish. So I would say in terms of trading horizon, I wouldn't look at it too much. I would look at, I mean, you know, what to me is tradable is the idea that there are going to be rate cuts. Absolutely not. Unless, you know, something really, we are hit by a meteorite or suddenly a extinct volcano starts to spew lava. And unless we have an absolutely magical disaster, there is no way the Fed can cut. And I would add that all these things that Joseph has been saying about the lack of bite of monetary policy, to me, it suggests that the Fed has to go much higher. So I'm not going to defend my Taylor rule right now because we are in an environment where, frankly, it's not relevant. But give us some time, you know, to get over the debt ceiling and to show that actually the credit crunch has very little impact on the U.S. economy because credit demand is not increasing. If you look at bank loans, they have been flat for the past 12 months, which is typical at this juncture in the business cycle. People are trying to repay their debt. In fact, there was a survey just this morning run by the Atlanta Fed that said exactly that. People don't want credit, they want to repay their debts. So let's talk again at the end of the year. And, you know, I bet you that the 7-8% won't sound as outlandish as it does now.
I'd also add that, you know, the Fed is hiking rates and that makes the front end rates go higher. But because the market is so convinced that the Fed is going to cut rates later on, the more economically sensitive parts of the curve, let's say the 10-year, haven't gone up as much. So even though the Fed is hiking rates, the way that it's supposed to feed into the real economy is more going to be to, let's say, where the 5-year or 10-year is trading, right? That's where corporate debt would be issued at. That's where mortgages would be based off of. And because everyone is so convinced that the Fed is going to cut rates later on, even though the Fed is hiking rates, the way that it flows through the system is kind of clogged a bit.
Right. And so before I give you, Joseph, the final word, people should check out your work, Joseph, on Twitter at FedGuy12, your book, Central Banking 101, your writings at FedGuy.com, and you recently revamped your website, so it looks very good.
Oh, yes. And
what were you going to say, Joseph?
Brian, I have a brand new YouTube channel, which is just starting, not as cool as Forward Guidance, not as great as Blockworks, but if you want, you can hear weekly market briefs from my channel. It's just called Joseph Wang.
Yes, definitely check that out as well. And Dominique, you on Twitter are at First Kick Tires, and people should check out your work at Macro Hive. So Joseph, I just want to give you the final word. Do you think that the debt ceiling in any way will, and the Federal Reserve's potential response, potentially aggressive response to help the Treasury out, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, will that in any way impede its ability to hike rates or even to keep rates high? The argument being, if things are so dire for the national government, why not just, you know, make things a little easier for everybody and cut rates?
Well, I don't think
magic again.
I don't think that rate cuts would make things easier. I think the problem might be that maybe we do, as Dominic has been hinting, that we do have tremendous amounts of polarization in our politics, and maybe we do get to X state, and maybe we do get the magic from the Fed where we prioritize payments. And after all that, nothing happens. No one gets defaulted on. Life goes on as usual. Maybe some people will get paid a little bit slower. Now, if that were to happen, I think the risk is that we have a prolonged session of negotiation because there's no pressure on Congress to negotiate anymore. I think that'd be really interesting and definitely creates a lot more uncertainty. From my perspective, the more concerning downside scenario that we talked a lot about, how Fed hiking has not been impactful and economy is so much stronger than many people expect. From my perspective, the one downside risk that could happen is that the result of the debt ceiling is tremendous spending cuts. Now, if that were to happen, then I think that, you know, the economy will very fast not be as strong as it appears to be. And we could have quick resolution to inflation, but we could also end up with a recession. And how severe really would depend upon how severe the spending cuts are. Now, 7% fiscal deficit, I think it's doing a lot to lift the economy. If that were to go away, it would be a significant slowdown.
Got it. Dominic, I'm actually going to give you the last word, but just Joseph. So your work saying the U.S. Treasury could issue up to $1 trillion in bills over the next 6 months. I'm sure that's happened before. In March 2020, the Treasury issued a ton, but that was when the Federal Reserve was doing tons of quantitative easing.
Right.
Is there any time in history where the Treasury's issued that much amount of paper while the Federal Reserve was doing quantitative tightening? And I mean, it sounds like a pretty dicey situation. What do you think?
So you're exactly right. So in 2020, the Treasury actually, I think, issued $2 trillion. So they issued twice as much. But like exactly as you mentioned, at that time, the Fed was also doing tremendous QE, so money was coming into the system, and people were really scared, and so they were happily buying up all those bills. Now we're at a situation today that's really different in that we're doing quantitative tightening, and the liquidity level in the banking system has been steadily dropping over the past few months, and it is a large issuance. I can't think of another situation that's like this. So there is a potential. Now, this is not my base case where this aggressive issuance actually really, really drains the level of liquidity in the bank sector really quickly and to a point where it falls below the level that the Fed is comfortable with. In that sense, I think there would be some actions by the Fed to try to paper things over a bit. And that's not my base case, but it's definitely a possibility because the issuance is so aggressive, as you noted. So far, the marginal buyers of Treasury bills have not been the money market funds. So this wouldn't drain the reverse repo facility. It drained the banking sector instead.
Got it. Dominique, give you the final word. How do you want to close this?
We hope that U.S. politics become a little less dysfunctional and that we find compromise soon and avoid the scenario of a dreadful fiscal tightening and ensuing recession.
There we go. We'll end it there. Thank you, Dominique. Thank you, Joseph, for joining us. And thank you, everyone, for watching. Wow, a lot of that went over my head, but I hope that you learned a little bit about the debt ceiling, because I know I certainly learned a lot. Before I go, that 40% discount to MacroHive Prime can be found at macrohive.com/jack. Their clients include some of the best institutional investors in the world, and I wouldn't partner with MacroHive if I didn't think that their product was a good fit with the Forward Guidance audience. Thanks, and till next time.